www.themouthmagazine.com.
Pleasure to be able to say for the second time, Eliza Carthy, welcome to the Mouthcast.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I remember the last time we spoke 3 years ago, you were at the seaside, though I can't quite remember where, and you were just about to take the girls out for cream tea. That was your afternoon treat.
That sounds like Sidmouth to me. It sounds like I was maybe we only do cream teas in Devon, so it sounds like I was at Sidmouth Festival.
It was. I think it was Sidmouth. Well, let's start there. Let's start with the girls. You're a professional musician, so how difficult has it been for you to balance those two things, motherhood and being a professional musician? Neither of which is the easiest pursuit, so has it been difficult for you to get to the position where you can balance the two things?
It's extremely difficult, actually. I'm not just a mother, but a single mother. So it's a constant balancing act, really. Sometimes it works well and sometimes it doesn't, you know. That's all there is to say about it, really. It's just important to make sure that the children get as much of my attention as I can give them, as well as me trying to make a living for us. And yeah, as I say, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't.
Do they come out on the road with you when you're on tour?
They do in the summer. We try not to take them out of school in term time. But I mean, when they were little, I did tour with Isabella until she was, I thought she was about a year old, I suppose. Florence until she was about 7 months. I like having them on the road with us. I enjoyed that very much. If it was up to me, I'd have them with me all the time. But, you know, they need pals and they need school, really. So, yeah, the on the road charabang, complete with teacher and all that kind of stuff isn't practical for me at the moment.
Are they musical, the girls?
Very much so. They both of them sing very beautifully. They've got great rhythm, loud little beggars. they like bashing things, and Florence is having fiddle lessons as well. But they both of them really, really love to sing.
Is a life in music something that you would dissuade them from because of the insecurities attached to that? Or do you think you'd be right behind them when the time comes that they might make that decision?
Knowing how useless that advice was to me when I was growing up, I would give it my best shot. But, I mean, certainly my mum didn't want me to be a professional musician. She certainly didn't want me to start as early as I started. So I'd give it a go, you know. I agree with her now, I have to say, because I think starting at 17, I mean, I turned professional at 17, started gigging when I was 13. The gigging when I was 13, part of it was her fault, to be fair, but turning pro at 17 probably was a bit too soon, to be honest. I've now officially never done anything else. I'm 41 and I've never done anything else. And it's great. Sometimes I think, you know, maybe I should have had a year out at some point. Some kids get to do that, and I've never done that. I don't know. You can always have regrets about something, can't you?
Yeah, of course.
There are ups and downs.
What might you have done then? What was going on for you academically? What interested you academically that might have led you down a different path?
Academically, I mean, I was already studying. I was studying music and history, so it wouldn't have been that much. It wouldn't have been that much different. It's still pretty much historical music that I'm doing now. I did want to be an author at one point, and I certainly the efforts of mine that weren't towards music were towards research for writing books. I wanted to write nonfiction novels, basically, or poetry. So it's not a massive step away, but I certainly wouldn't have done as much travelling as I've done now. But that was the only other choice for me, really.
So do you write? Do you write prose?
I don't anymore. No. No, I was commissioned by the BBC to write a story for Radio 4. When was that? That was last year or the year before. We did. That was the year before last. I wrote a piece called "The Announcer's Daughter," which was read out on the radio by a very nice lady, and it did very well. They put music to it as well. I wrote that, which I thought could be the first chapter of a book. I haven't written anything else around it since. I'm thinking about releasing a full version of it as a what do you call it? What do you call it?
Audiobooks.
Audiobook, there you go. I'm thinking about releasing a full version of it in a few months' time because they had to abridge it and everything, and I'd quite like to put it out because I was very proud of it, and it was nice to know that I could still do it as well. So I think everyone's got one book in them, haven't they? I've got a very strong idea, but I'm not pursuing it right now. 12-piece band to look after and all that.
What was that like for you to hear that on the radio? Because you've gigged for so many years that I don't imagine the nerves thing comes into it, but you may have been quite nervous about hearing the radio piece broadcast because that's an entirely different discipline.
I suppose it is. No, I didn't really get any nerves. No, because I actually knew it was all right. I enjoy reading. I've always been a big reader. So, no, I was more excited than anything else. I was more excited to be doing something different, and I thought it was worthwhile, and the producer told me it was worthwhile and everything. I was very excited as to what they did with it as well. The lady that read it out had the most beautiful voice, and the music fit really, really well. As a piece, I thought it worked very, very well. So I do still get nervous with the music, though. It depends on the circumstances. You might think that larger audiences, they don't bother me so much. It's more like when your old teacher's in the room, that kind of thing. Right. That's when it really gets you.
Because I saw you a few years ago in Sheffield, and it was the most confident walk, not in an arrogant way, by the way, but it was the most confident walk to a stage that I'd ever seen, I think.
Right.
You had the audience in the palm of your hand before you'd even played a note. It was fantastic.
Oh, thank you. Sheffield would have been a nervous one, actually, because I don't play in Yorkshire very much, not out of choice, but for some reason it's... I don't get booked too much close to home, so it was probably all bravado on my part.
It worked. Okay, since we last spoke 3 years ago, there's been a fair few musical things going on for you, actually. There's been the album The Moral of the Elephant, recorded with your dad, Martin. I think you were in the process of recording that, actually, last time we spoke. There's the album Laylam as part of Carthy Hardy Farrell Young, and the album Bottle with Tim Erickson. Working on collaborative projects like that, do you have to tap into a completely different side of yourself than you might for solo work? Is it much more about sensitivity or deference, I think, is what I'm getting at?
Oh, deference is an interesting one. I don't think myself and Tim were ever much into deference as far as each other was concerned. I think we were more like, what if I poke him this way? If I poke him this way, will it make him dance? You know. But then we're very, very old friends, so yeah, there's a bit more of that kind of thing going on. With my dad, again, deference is a very funny word. I'm not sure it's something I would. I think with Dad, I think the pressure more came from the fact that he worked with Dave Swarbrick. And he was, you know, my dad was already known for playing with a fiddle player that everybody quite liked a lot. You know, so I was perhaps worried that I wouldn't make the grade in that. So I also wanted to make sure that any material that I came up with was good enough for him, because obviously my dad is a heavyweight as far as material is concerned, and I didn't want to come to the table with a load of lightweight ideas. I think we overcame that. I came to the table with some good ideas, but also the way that we recorded the album and everything was my idea, and I was very, very proud of that. The way that we workshopped the album, the way that we recorded everything almost live, was very, very challenging for both of us. So I managed to come up with something that was challenging and interesting for him, and I hope for his audience as well as for me and for my audience. I'm very proud of The Moral of the Elephant for that. Also, it can't be said that any of the material on the album is lightweight at all. So, yeah, I was very careful about my choices. Having been, slightly dismissive of that idea when it comes to Tim Erickson, also Tim Erickson's choices of material and standing as a musician are really very, very serious. And I wanted to make sure, again, musically, that we both had something to chew on. And I think, again, the dialogue between me and Tim was very honest and straightforward, and that we actually came out with something that satisfied us on all kinds of levels. We're also planning on making a second album together as well, so I must have done something right.
fly swifter than day. Fa la 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 la. Eyes quickly or how they will all fly away now. Fa la 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 la. Rise quickly, my darling, and quickly I tell thee how the sun, moon, and stars are on fire in my belly. Daddy's house top of the way now. Fa la 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 la. If he should chide me for staying too long, I'll tell him the fumes of your bottle were strong. Fa la 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 la.
Of course, Eliza, in 2014 you were awarded the MBE. I'm very interested in that, as your political views are clearly left-leaning, and I've always thought of you as a rebel, actually, quite anti-establishment, probably in the best folk tradition. I wondered if there was some wrestling with your conscience about accepting that award.
There definitely was, but my family has been there before, twice, if you like, and I was aware of both of my parents' reasons for accepting theirs. I was aware of it, and I was very much in agreement with them as well. So when the call came, I imagine that there was a lot less wringing of hands and tearing of hair, and a lot more, this is actually great for the establishment to recognise a younger generation of traditional musician, and for the established to recognise traditional music in general. And the traditional music community as a thing, because people don't necessarily know that we exist. So yes, whilst I'm not hopping around that Queenie invited me to tea, you know, I'd be quite happy to go to tea with anybody, but, you know, I don't necessarily recognise her job as a viable and sustainable option for the world. Whilst we weren't happy about it in that way, we're certainly happy that traditional music and the people that helped get all of us to this point in the modern world with surviving traditional music is quite a rare and special thing, and I'm glad that we're all here, and I'm glad that we're still recognised and celebrated within the traditional community, that is.
Yeah. I remember a little bit of trolling going on Twitter. You were accused of selling out by somebody, I seem to recall.
Not for long, I don't think. It wasn't one of those death threat kind of standoffs, you know. I think certainly somebody said something. Go ahead.
I couldn't help but think that you may also have had your tongue in your cheek a little bit, and that might have been missed. Am I, does that make sense?
My tongue in my cheek, what, accepting the award?
Yeah.
No, absolutely not.
Okay.
No, I took it extremely seriously. Being an anti-monarchist, and I am an anti-monarchist very, very much, to accept something from the Queen isn't something that I would take lightly, no. And the way I see it is that MBEs are there to celebrate ordinary people who try to do something for their communities. And everybody else that was there certainly represented that, whether they were from the military, which I'm not particularly a massive fan of either, but whether they were from the military or whether they were from the health service, the education service. One of the things that people get wrong about MBEs is that they are, you know, that we have to call you lady now, we have to bow now and all that kind of stuff. That's not at all what the MBE is about. It might be what the OBE and the knighthoods and all of that are about, but MBEs actually celebrate people within ordinary communities that try and do something above and beyond. Everybody that I met was doing that, and so for me to have gone in there wearing a red nose would have been inappropriate, and I'm glad that I didn't.
Let's talk a bit about the new album Big Machine, which is coming out in early February. The title suggests something very strong, and I have to say that the snippets I've heard really do back that theory up. Even actually the imagery that's already available, these really stark and striking shots of you and the rest of the Wayward Band, are absolutely mesmerising. I don't know whether I'm looking at some kind of historic photo of a pagan tribe or a convention of young butchers or something. The pictures are formidable, actually. They're a bit scary.
Yeah, well, they're all covered in blood and wielding weapons, so they were intended to be like that. The imagery represents the first single, which was written in the 19th century by a woman called Caroline Norton, who she was an activist. She was a writer and campaigner for, I want to say, women's rights, but she didn't characterise herself as a feminist. She was... She basically wrote and campaigned to have women recognised as something other than property post the breakup of a marriage.
Right.
She also changed the law through that campaigning relating to the rights of infants before they were 7 years old to also not be seen as the property of their fathers, but to have some access to their mothers. Because once you split up from your husband, if that ever happened, and it didn't matter how that happened, in Caroline Norton's case, her husband was a horribly abusive man. And when she left him through necessity because she was being brutalised, she was separated from her three children, one of whom was very, very young at the time, and they were all under seven. And she never saw them again. Well, she never saw them again until many, many years later. And in the case of her youngest, he actually died through neglect.
Right.
And the next time that she saw him was at his funeral. It was a very sad story. And she was a very successful writer. She didn't earn any money from that herself because everything went to her husband. But the work that she did, the stuff that she wrote, really, really spoke of in the horrible, horrible situation that she was living in. And for me, Fade and Fall, the lead single, the song that she wrote, it was a poem at the time, I made a chorus out of it and everything, is a sort of outpouring of the most terrible sadness.
Yeah.
Having said that, she did overcome all of that and she did change the law in this country for women and for their children. And that conversation, the conversation about women and fathers and their children, is still going on today. And I wanted to use that song because it related to me not only in that way, being a single mother, but also because I think, it's hard to say this, but I think that the way that our society is at the moment, we very much feel part of a big machine that seems to be sort of careening out of control.
Yes, yeah.
And I think a lot of people are trying in very, very small ways in some cases and in very large ways in other cases, trying to construct a new society. And so those photographs, for me, represent trying to construct something new ideologically, whether that be politically, whether that be personal political, whether it be whatever. And a lot of the songs on the album are kind of about that in some way or another, some less obviously than others. But that's what the photos represent for me. They represent a small band of knocked up people, knocked about people trying to build something new. And I think those photographs really represent that. And as I say, you can react to them in any way you want. You can react to them if you know who Caroline Norton is. You can react to them in that way. If you don't know who she is, you can listen to the words of the song and react in that way. In some ways, it's kind of post-apocalyptic. It's almost as if the world has been burned to the ground. And ideologically, we're all trying to make some kind of sense out of it. That's what it's about. And I think that's why people are reacting so very, very strongly to it, because it was a very, very singular idea that we had, that we pursued throughout all the photographs. And certainly when the booklet comes out, there's going to be a 50-page booklet with the special edition CD.
Right.
And all of those photographs are going to represent the same thing. And the video as well. The video for Fade and Fall is going to come out in a couple of weeks, and that also is going to represent that as well. And
excellent.
I think it's going to... There's no messing about with this traditional music. I think sometimes bands and traditional music, I think we're sometimes a little bit shy and we sometimes want to, I don't know, it's almost like we want to caper about in a funny outfit, you know. And whilst we are clearly wearing outfits, the material is not tongue-in-cheek. It's not to be sniffed at or laughed at or kind of, hey, look at me jigging about sort of thing. It's not like that. It's serious blood music, and we very, very much wanted to represent that on this album. Having said that, there is a song about dying from custard poisoning at the end of the record, but I thought everybody perhaps needed a bit of a break.
It's interesting that you have explained all of that, because the country has lurched to the right in the last few years, and the refugee crisis and the European referendum seem to have brought out the worst in many people. And because I know that you are politically minded and personally politically minded, I did expect or anticipate some sort of statement on that.
Mm. Well, there certainly is. The second single, was it going to be one of the singles now? I can't remember. But the single that we put out last year, You Know Me, has had a major rewrite, and we've invited an MC by the name of MC Disraeli to come along and make additional comment, if you like, on the song itself. So we've rejigged the whole song. Last year, we were all frolicking about in an orchard, being very welcoming, and look, we're all having a party and having a glass of wine, and it's all great, and you can all come and join us. This year, it's gotten very dark and very hard. I don't think any of us imagined when the refugee crisis kicked off last year that it was going to last so long and become so very upsetting. The mood in our country has changed beyond all my recognition.
Yeah.
Certainly,
yeah.
I think certainly as a human community, you'd like to imagine that things are getting better all the time, that we're following our evolutionary path and it's going to be fine. But actually, things have taken a very, very dark turn, especially in this country. Racial attacks have increased by more than a third in this country. You know, I just read something this morning about a busker in Bath being yelled at for playing Eastern European tunes on his violin, which is just outrageous. People are being attacked on the bus and nobody is doing anything. Teenage girls are being targeted. Women and small children are being targeted. I think it's all come about because we have allowed certain rhetoric to continue, the rhetoric of the swarms and the rhetoric of UKIP. We've allowed David Cameron to take on that. We allowed him to take on the language of that and then just walk away.
Yeah,
he's gone now. He's waltzed off. Nigel Farage has waltzed off and left the rest of us in this bloody mess. This horrible, horrible mess that nobody had a plan for. And I think it was extremely irresponsible to launch the referendum at all in the middle of the refugee crisis. We should have sorted that out first. When he announced it, when he actually announced that it was happening, there'd been some other headlines the previous day about more people drowning in the Mediterranean. And I just looked at my dad and I went, are we really going to do this now?
Mm.
The news is going to take this over for the next 8 months. We're really doing this now, are we? And I thought, we are literally all going to hell. That's the most irresponsible thing I've ever heard of in my life. And I don't know where things are going to go. And we have seen where things are going to go. People think it's all right to just parrot the Daily Mail back at you. It's not. And these are human beings. They're not a swarm. They're not migrants. They are refugees. And they're going through the most terrifying things. Hundreds of thousands of children are being lost. And I just don't understand why we think it's more important to have bent bananas. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah, yeah.
It's almost laughable if it wasn't so tragic. So yes, we've made our little statement on there, and I'm very much nailing my flag to that. Anybody can come and stay here. We've got plenty of room. Shut up. We've got loads of room. And that's where I'm at. So
good. Okay, Eliza, to round up, there's been a resurgence in interest in folk music over the last 15 years or so, I'd say. We have artists like Kate Rusby being a kind of Radio 2 staple in a way. And actually, I think in one way of looking at it, we could say that she's now a mainstream artist rather than a folk artist. I did a podcast with Martin Simpson a few months ago, and his theory was that there are a lot of artists, Kate, Seth Lakeman and yourself, who have now become an influence over the next generation, and that because young folk have access to the internet and everything is available and they're more open-minded, folk is not a dirty word anymore.
I have a slight problem with the idea that folk and mainstream are two different things, but that's just me being a nerd.
Okay.
She's more of a folk artist if she's in the mainstream, surely. because the folk are out there, they're not in here.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I suppose the problem there is, what is the definition of folk music, isn't it?
Oh, it always boils down to that in the end, and we'd be here till Christmas if we started on that. Personally, I think folk music and traditional music are two different things. And I think what Kate Rusby does is somewhere in between the two.
Yeah.
And I wonder if what I do is somewhere in between the two, but in a different way. Whether there's folk as populism and folk as art music, and whether she's one and whether I'm another, or whether we ever swap, I don't know.
Yeah, I can see that.
I think the artist that has had the most impact over the last 5 years has been Bellowhead, and it's been really fun to see a big band, if you like, a band with really big, somewhat grandiose sometimes ideas to sort of get onto Radio 2. Not to dismiss what Kate does in any way at all, certainly in the last 5 years, I would say that she is probably very, very, very well established now. And I'm not going to say the young bucks, because some of the people in that band are older than me, but the new bucks, if you like, okay. In the last 5 years has been on Bellowhead and what they've managed to achieve. I think all the other things that you said are true. I think, yes, the people that are interested in folk at whatever age have a greater access to what they like on the internet. It's also easier to search for more things. And although we all hate those dreaded, what do you call them, that predict what you like.
Algorithms.
Algorithms, yes. As much as everybody hates algorithms, they do occasionally show you a good thing. And certainly when it comes to music, it's great every now and then to have, whether it's a digital robot or one of your mates just poke you and go, what about that? What do you think about that? Folk music can really get around in that way. We've always been a cottage industry, but we have more power in our hands now with the internet. And if you know how to work it, you've got as much chance as the next bloke. And I really do appreciate that. As far as I've concerned, I've been so far concerning myself with the fringes of what people like in some ways. I've always made things quite difficult for people. I've never done the same thing twice. I've always, you know, scratched around in the obscure areas of folk music, and perhaps, I don't know, perhaps Radio 2 will become interested in me one day. But until then, I think the stages and the atmosphere has become a lot kinder for all of us. And I think we've all had a little bit to do with that. Hopefully I've held some doors open for people. And I certainly feel like Bellowhead are currently holding the door open for me, which is a very, very nice feeling. So who knows? I think we're doing all right at the moment. I don't see any waning of interest just now. I do know that a couple of the mainstream newspapers have lost their folk music reviews. For instance, I think it's the Telegraph and the Guardian. They don't differentiate anymore. I think it's just a sort of scrabble to the top as to who gets on the interesting list, whether that be classical or folk or jazz or world music or whatever. I think it's a scrabble to the top on that on a weekly basis as to who gets that review, as to what genre gets that review. But as far as the internet's concerned, and as far as digital sales and all that kind of stuff is concerned, things have never been healthier for us. People don't necessarily like what they're spoon-fed anymore, and that can only be good for folk music, really.
Love not, you hopeless sons of clay. Hope's gayest wreaths are made of early flowers, and things are made to fade and fall away when they have blossomed but a few short hours. Upon its birth.
www.themouthmagazine.com.